Flight of Fancy. Written by Grace Lesso and Silent Walrus, and read by Devil with a Bird Dress. Author note. The most time-consuming part of this process was deciding how Amestrians respond to a sneeze. Ed swings by Roy's office, which he shouldn't be able to do given the security arrangements, but does anyway a couple of times a week, around 12:30. It's earlier than Roy usually likes to eat, but a convenient 90 minutes, Corain's still sharing his diary with Ed, it seems. He really should talk to her about it again, given the security risks, but it's not like he minds, and anyway, it's Ed, before his meeting with the Drachman trade delegation, for which he's already perfectly prepared. Thanks to the sterling efforts of his professional staff, Roy finds himself comprehensively briefed 5 working days in advance of all meetings. The other key point in favor of having a highly competent team of subordinates is that the primary points of the negotiation have already been hashed out in offices without wood paneling, or will be later rehashed to integrate as seamlessly as possible, i.e., minimally and to a face-saving degree only, any ministerial curveballs thrown during the meeting. So his 2 p.m. is not quite a photo op, as he'll still be expected to make and respond to some statements, but all that's required of him will be spontaneous repackagings of heavily refined policy positions in whose development he had only a nominal hand. All in all, then, the perfect time for lunch. Ed doesn't come into the office, or say anything, for that matter. He stands in the doorway, head at shoulder height of the officer standing guard, crunching loudly on a nest of deep-fried strands that smells powerfully of onion and drips a prodigious amount of oil down his wrist. His other hand holds out 2 brown paper bags with conspicuous and growing grease stains on the lower third. Beneath the onion, notes of sharp pickled cucumber, grilled meat, and warm dough drift across the floor with intent. Roy sighs and caps his pen, then tilts his head at Ed. "The carousel stand in the churchyard?" he asks, limply feigning neutrality. His stomach gurgles, but not loudly enough for Ed to hear. "Umph," nods Ed around his onion. "It's really beautiful outside." Then he sneezes. Twice. "Good health, good luck," Roy rattles off automatically, watching Ed struggle to keep his mouth shut and avoid spewing half-chewed batter across the office. The violent jerking tears one of the steam-softened bags, a neat, foil-wrapped tube rolling out and across the hardwood. "Oops," Ed says thickly, eyes streaming, looking at the elegant smear of opaque pinkish sauce left in its wake. "I'll take that one." The next sneeze doesn't catch him off guard quite so badly. He manages to get the crook of his elbow most of the way in front of his face and avoids slinging Roy's lunch into the bookshelves in the process. "Good riddance, get fucked. Pollen?" "Pollen." Ed sounds forlorn and unpleasantly runny as he stoops to collect his escaped lunch, swiping the remnants of the paper bag through the sauce smear. Roy silently thanks his assistant for scheduling the trade talks in a conference room instead of his office. "And you're proposing we have lunch in the park?" Ed snaps up with all the righteous country boy energy he can muster. "You think I'd miss a day like this for allergies? What am I, some kind of limp-wristed indoorsman?" "Not at all, and don't even think about becoming one," says Roy, placidly, offering him a handkerchief. He graciously chooses not to remind Ed that he spent several hours last weekend trying to refashion a cast-off sheepskin rug into acceptable house slippers after borrowing Roy's. "You know how I feel about usurpers." Ed duly scrubs the handkerchief across his outraged face and up his left hand, and then goes to return it, catching the gesture halfway as he realizes that, no matter how much Roy might care about him, a damp, onion-greased scrap of cloth is never a desirable gift. Roy redirects him by pointing with his pen. "There should be a pack of antihistamines in the cabinet." While Ed rattles around in there, Roy neatens up his desk, aligning his 3 identical pens in strict order of preference and squaring the corners of his papers. He shoots a quick burst of flame into the ceramic urn he uses for confidential waste and stands up. "Jacket?" he asks Ed, who's convulsing gently as he attempts to dry swallow a pill. Ed shakes his head vigorously, makes a dramatic choking sound for effect, then shows Roy his tongue as proof of success. "Revolting," Roy comments, shouldering his own coat but not committing to wearing it in deference to the wool of his uniform. "Shall we?" "Ugh, pansy," Ed returns at Roy's coat, leading the way outside. "There's not even a breeze out there. Come on." Roy follows him out, picking up the close protection detail on the way, which acquiesces to Roy's definition of close once they cross the tree-lined promenade and reach the park, which, while the greenest area within a 10-mile walk of HQ, lacks the foliage to really qualify as one. There's a sad attempt at a flower bed by the gate, but whoever planted it up was decidedly not blessed with green thumbs. Or, apparently, going by the disparate spatter of geraniums beginning to show purple between the mangy remains of daffodils, color vision. Ed bulldozes past this horticultural catastrophe without sparing a backward glance at Roy, takes a slight detour to deposit his various bits of oil-soaked refuse in a polythene sack hanging from a sad little metal hoop, and over towards the benches by the so-called water feature. Certainly, it has water, but it's pushing the limits of credibility to call what appears to be a length of garden hose sticking straight up out of a sinkhole a feature. As they approach, Roy realizes with resigned disgust that the best bench, the one with the high, curving back and great sightlines, is, of course, absolutely infested with pigeons. Some doddering retiree clearly blew out their pension on birdseed and carted it all here in a fugue of benevolent senility, addled by age and visions of frolicking woodland creatures, and likely very excited to exacerbate the vermin problem plaguing the city. Roy wonders if he can assign a guard rota to the parks on the basis of proximity to HQ, and lay standing orders to have all bird feeders arrested on sight. Public hygiene is, after all, a very important matter. Perhaps he should memo the internal ministry with regard to a propaganda campaign to that effect. In reflecting on this kind of high-level policy crafting, however, he's allowed himself to fall somewhat behind in step, which Ed does not fail to notice. He glances back at Roy, one arm reaching out to offer him his lunch, then at the bench, then frowns. "What, you scared of birds? Come on, they'll push right off soon as we get close." Roy wonders if he can get away with claiming he's precluding all risk of getting bird shit on his uniform. It may be better to eat somewhere else. Cleaner, for one. Ed, however, has the blood-spotting instincts of a reincarnated piranha and is the ravenous leech in the murky pool of Roy's life, living off any paper cut in his dignity besides. "You are scared of birds," he says, awe and delight transforming his damp and vaguely swollen features into a vision of transcendent malice. "You're totally scared of them. Roy Mustang, scared of pigeons." "I've just had some bad experiences," Roy says, before Ed can go take out an ad in the paper. "Aw, do you have childhood trauma? Did some bad little goose chase you across the yard? Did a chicken peck your knee a little too hard?" "Firstly, neither geese, chickens, nor yards featured at any point in my childhood, blessed be. Secondly," Roy says, and decides, in the manner of all good ad hoc field surgeons, to amputate the limb in the interests of saving the patient. "There was one particular experience, and I recognize that it hardly reflects well on me, where I exploded a pigeon." As expected, this immediately draws Ed in, like a cockroach scuttling towards darkness. "What? When? Why?" "It was in the academy," Roy says, heaving a sigh as if it was all very tragic instead of mortifying on several moral, personal, and professional levels. "I and several other state alchemist hopefuls were taking advantage of the yard to develop techniques that would show well on the practical portion of the exam. There were always pigeons about, of course, but as cadets were responsible for cleaning and maintaining the grounds, we all had a special place in our hearts for the birds." "Because they shit everywhere and are impossible to keep off?" Ed supplies helpfully. Because they shit everywhere and are impossible to keep off. Yes. So we would all try and leave no bird unmolested, as it were. Ed makes a sound that immediately makes Roy regret his phrasing. Well, since he's apparently leaning into his problems today. You're from sheep country, Ed. I'm from the city. We don't have an abundance of free-range mammals frolicking about for our entertainment. Ed's leaky, bloodshot eyes overspill a little more, probably helped by the way Roy can hear his own voice coming out stiff and prim. Anyway, he says, vocal cords partially starched, we were talking about my first murder. That day, there was a rumor that some of the exam board officers would be touring the academy to inspect prospective talent. So, when a pigeon flew my way, in the interests of demonstrating the precision applications of alchemy on a moving target, I shot a fireball at it. Of course, that's technically incorrect. The aiming portion of Roy's alchemy is achieved by supersaturating the target space with oxygen, so that, by the time he snaps a spark, it travels along a predetermined path, deliberately built and exactingly calculated. It's easier to say, shot a fireball, than explain what's actually happening, and how it precludes the possibility of missing. It's also eliding the detail that he only found out about the rumor after the fact, when he was hauled into the director's office, expecting to be chastised for risking damage to military property outside of regulation settings. This, of course, immediately became an applied lesson in physics, Roy continues. Namely, the fact that an object in motion tends to stay in motion, even if it is now dead and on fire. So I ended up hit right in the face with a
flaming dead pigeon,
Ed squeaks, clearly overcome with moral outrage over this wanton cruelty to animals. That's how I lost my first eyebrow, Roy sighs, and gained my first commission. Like so, he adds, activating his circle, and snaps. What he meant to do was set off a very small explosion in the empty space between pigeons, enough to demonstrate what he'd done and scare them all off to boot. In line with the true nature of pigeondom, however, just as the spark leaves his glove, one torpid, feathery rat gives an erratic lurch in exactly the wrong direction. The explosion is smaller, messier, and considerably more disgusting than intended due to the sudden introduction of wet carbon. Instead of eating up a patch of concentrated gas in a clean little flare, a flaming pigeon careens into the sky, propelled as much by its own wings as by the derailed exothermic reaction. This instantaneously sets every other pigeon aflight, which both was the original plan and is horribly reminiscent of the Academy courtyard circa 20 years ago, only this time the damn roasted pigeon is still alive because Roy hadn't been trying to kill anything, fuck damn it, so it's flapping and making horrible shrieking noises, and also very likely to set fire to all the other birds panicking around it as well, setting off a chain reaction accidental avian genocide. Roy snaps again. This time, the explosion is bigger. The protection detail, of course, comes sprinting up through the pandemonium, pistols drawn, and more than a little wild-eyed. Something very like a charcoal briquette crashes to the ground at Roy's feet. Ed, beside him, sinks to his knees, head bowed over the blackened lump. That, Roy says, about to make some kind of appropriate statement, relegating all this into the realm of the reasonable, or, at the very least, abasing himself for his violent and destructive nature. Then he realizes Ed is literally crying laughing.
You blew up a pigeon, Ed wheezes. You blew up 50 pigeons, 500 pigeons.
Sir, says Sergeant Ajax, in very wooden tones as he assesses the scene.
Twice! Ed is now squeaking, practically rocking back and forth around the takeout clutched to his chest. You fucked up pigeon murder twice! You're not good at it!
Sir, we advise that we move to a less volatile location, Ajak insists. Charred feathers continue to drift down around them like a sign from God.
You're bad at it! The one thing you're good for!
Well, Roy says, as he realizes it's less a fundamentally violent and destructive nature he's got in Ed's eyes than an invariably incompetent one. It's dead, isn't it? This makes Ed keel over further in apoplectic hilarity. The remaining flock, smoking gently in places and looking even more bedraggled than usual, resettles itself on the second best bench, and Roy gives the idea of a park lunch up as a dead loss.
Oh my god, Ed hiccups. Oh, that was so good. I think my throat's closing up.
Right, Roy says, ignoring the two former covert operatives flanking him like any good assassination target, as this cements itself as yet another incident in his life where his most catastrophic tendencies elevate him in both station and regard of those nearest and dearest to his, for lack of a better word, heart. Perhaps it says something about the morbid little horrors that he surrounds himself with, but then again, he's not in the business of failing to take what he can get. With him helming things, as Maze used to say, the future's so bright they're getting radiation sickness. Let's get you to the epinephrine. End. Thank you for listening.